6 of our Pixar rewatch. Today we are talking about the movie The Incredibles.
Yeah.
And with us today, as always, we have Mr. Jimmy Anthony, and he is going to be our syndrome.
Oh,
yeah. Oh, look at that. You got me monologuing.
I don't know.
Something close like, enough. Yeah. We have Cynthia Anthony, and she's going to be Mirage.
Oh, darling. Really? Is that Mirage?
Yeah.
Yeah.
Oh, that's the other character.
A word.
Well,
no. Oh, yeah. Edna.
Wait, yeah. Who is the designer?
Oh, Edna. You could be Edna.
She could totally be Edna.
Yeah, that's true. You should be Edna.
No case.
So I'm Edna. I could have told you that all my life. With his signature glasses and amazing scarves. How did you not know?
Amazing scarves.
We have Jacob Shearer. He's going to be Mr. Incredible.
Oh, honey. I miss the old days. That's all I got.
We have Brian Baldwin. He's going to be Violet.
Oh, okay. Just invisible, that's fine, that works. You know, Violet is that she's like voiced by an old person. What's her name? Sarah Vowell, I think, or something.
Yeah, yeah. Something like
that. We'll later.
See. Yeah, we will.
She's like, ah, Jack.
Yeah.
I can't.
I'm trying. Yeah, Sarah Vowell, you're right. Yeah, she's just like, she's like, why isn't nobody, what does anyone in this family know about normal?
Ooh, that's good.
That was good, Kelly.
Was it? Okay. I can be Violet, I guess. Daniel McCarley is here. He's going to be Dash.
Cool.
I guess it makes sense for me to be Violet because I'm your sister and their brother and sister. So we'll go back to Brian and he can be Elastigirl.
Oh, I'm Holly Hunter. I can't do her voice.
No, she has a very specific voice for sure.
Like. Yeah. It's all teeth.
Yeah.
All right.
Seriously, honey. Seriously.
Yeah, she's got like an underbite.
Seriously, I can't move my left side of my mouth.
A stiff jaw and an underbite or something.
Yeah.
You guys, I feel like you sound like some other actor right now, but I couldn't tell you who, but.
We just sound like,
oh, like Sean
she
Connery.
Smoked for 40 years.
That's what I thought. Sean Connery.
He should have been in The Incredibles, damn it.
I know. There's a lot of James Bond references.
Mm-hmm.
All right. So, yes, we are talking about 2004's The Incredibles, the 6th Pixar animated movie. And I'm going to turn it over to Daniel to give us some of our box office and Oscar trivia.
So, The Incredibles was released in the United States in November of 2004. Was big over Thanksgiving, and it finished as the 5th highest grossing movie of that year in the United States. It made $260 million, finished behind Shrek 2, Spider-Man 2, The Passion of the Christ, and Meet the Fockers. It made $663 million worldwide. So it was not as big as Finding Nemo, the last movie, but it was still very big. And then it went on to be nominated for several Oscars. It won Best Original or Best Animated Movie and Best Sound Editing. I was dismayed to learn that the music was not nominated. It was not nominated for original score. I know. I had the same reaction. Like, that doesn't make any sense. Because, yeah, when I was in high school, the soundtrack was pretty huge. If we played it and stuff. Although I don't know if you would have played it in marching band with me, but.
No, that was your sophomore year. And I, right? And I was in seventh
grade. That was my junior year. You would have been in eighth grade. So, but did you play in like another band or something?
We played it at Biola youth music, like an arrangement of it. Yeah. So I did technically play the music once, but
my high school
band
played it. Sorry.
For marching band?
I didn't mean to interrupt. No, but just concert band. But we tried to rush it for like a fundraiser event, and it didn't come out very good because it's kind of tough music.
Yeah.
So,
yeah.
Really like a song, like a song with like vocals, even like a credits and credits song from it that you're like, oh, that's from The Incredibles, you know?
Mm-hmm. Yeah. I mean, the theme is pretty recognizable and memorable. Ba-da-ba-ba-da. But yeah.
Yeah.
But that, you're right. No songs.
There isn't like a, you know, Sarah McLachlan song.
Unfortunately.
I know, right? Mm. In the Arms of an Angel. Surprisingly not written for The Incredibles.
The only other thing that I would mention is it was nominated for original screenplay.
That is
it was?
Yeah, it was nominated for Best Musical or Comedy.
I love that.
Clever.
Like that acclaimed. Creative about like a family of superheroes that are like, you know, dealing with family issues as well as like their powers and all of that, you know. I think that it was like, I think that it had been explored and done a little bit, but not in this like mainstream of like a Disney way, you know. I mean, I think that like, I don't know, I'm sure there were TV shows and stuff and have been movies that had families of superheroes. I can't really think of one like off the top of my head, but it's not like that crazy of an idea. But I think that just the fact that like they did fully flesh out this idea like in a fresh way for the time, you know, makes it really good.
I agree with you, Brian. It is exceedingly original. So, Daniel, who did win for original screenplay that year?
The winner was Eternal Sunshine of the Spotless Mind.
Really? Best.
That won original screenplay.
I love that movie, so I'm happy to hear it.
Didn't that also win Best
Picture?
Yeah,
I can't complain too much about that. No, the Best Picture was Million Dollar Baby.
Oh, yeah, that was a ripoff.
Not Meet the Fockers? What?
Well, Eternal Sunshine was nominated, though, for sure, right?
No, not for Best Picture.
What? Yeah. I thought I remember.
It's the kind of... It was the kind of like big indie movie that like often would win original screenplay in those days. I feel like the screenplay awards are usually where Oscars will like give indie films, you know, they'll give awards. So, yeah, I should rewatch Eternal Sunshine. I just saw that. That's a great movie. Anyway, off track.
Depressing.
That's kind of all I have for your box office and Oscar trivia.
All right. So, yeah, we already said some of these, but some other movies that came out that year was a lot of sequels, Princess Diaries 2, Shrek 2, like you said, the Polar Express, Cinderella Story, Harry Potter 3, and Fat Albert. So, like, not a ton of, like, super
Kenan,
great.
Right? Kenan played Fat Albert. Didn't he?
Wasn't it Eddie Murphy?
Oh, I thought it was Kenan. All right.
Yeah, so Incredibles.
Jimmy's right. It was.
Oh, Kenan. Really?
You're thinking of a different movie with Eddie Murphy.
Okay. Yeah, some other ones. Passion of the Christ. Napoleon Dynamite. 13 Going on 30, Friday Night Lights, The Butterfly Effect, Crash. So Crash won Best Picture for this year then.
No, Crash was 05.
Oh, then that's wrong. Sideways was another big indie movie with Eternal Sunshine. And then The Aviator came out that year. So not as big of a year as our past years have been.
Actually, well... 04 was a pretty big year.
That's when the Razor came out, the phone.
Right.
Just to put it in perspective.
That's so funny.
Oh, yeah.
Dude, flip phones. Dude, yes.
We had them in school, and it was like a whole new thing. Texting.
Yeah, no phones outside the backpack.
What's that vibration noise? I don't know.
Right. And then it was like, for safety, though, I need it. My mom might need to call me.
Yeah.
Which is actually, like, I think why they let kids have their phone now. I think it's, yeah. Anyway.
Oh, my mom's trying to call me because I have a dentist appointment. I got to go.
Yeah.
I mean,
dude, it's
you'd hear it all.
Kids still like, do that.
Like, you've been chosen.
Yeah.
Please come to the office with your things. And you're like, fuck yeah.
Yes.
Music in my ears. Sorry.
All right, let's talk about some more fun facts, Jimmy.
All right, well, I got a bunch, guys, so I'll just go through them. Feel free to, like, chime in about anything you find interesting. First of all, this is the only Pixar film written by one person, Brad Bird. Thought it was interesting. The original title, when he conceived of it, was The Invincibles.
I think I heard that.
Yeah.
Incredible.
It would really lower the stakes.
Yeah, yeah, sure, exactly. Yeah. I think it's a little too on the nose with sort of the theme about, like, extra special people, too. But Incredibles is as well. But Invincible implies, like, I don't know, like you're godly. Yeah, I don't know. Yeah. All right. Brad Bird got the idea for this movie in the early 1990s, basing the story on his own experiences trying to balance a career with family. Makes sense. John Lasseter tried to coax Brad Bird to come to join him in 1995 when Pixar was working on A Bug's Life in 1998, which was released in 1998. Bird declined. When he left 20th Century Fox, Lasseter asked again, but Bird turned him down again, as he had a contract with Warner Brothers to make The Iron Giant in 1999. Cool. Yeah, so
wait,
that's...
Is The Iron Giant a superhero story?
Kind of.
It's about a robot and a boy. Okay.
But like a boy befriends this big giant robot, and it's sort of like a King Kong. King Kong kind of thing. Yeah. However, when Warner Brothers failed to properly promote the film, Bird finally agreed to join Pixar. Lasseter had only one request for his friend: make the film you've been dying to make. As Bird had been sitting on the idea for making a cartoon about a family of superheroes for over a decade, this movie was the natural choice. The movie is likely set in an alternate 1960s universe. And actually, I just saw an article where they zoom in on one of the newspapers that Mr. Incredible is looking at, and it actually does show the date 1962. So that was something Kelly and I were talking about. Like,
is that
when
the beginning of the movie, or like the main part of the movie?
Well, no, the beginning of that movie is like set like 10 years prior to
15. Because the opening sequence, it says 15 years later. And we got into a whole discussion of like, this looks very like 50s, 60s, but they have like cell phones, like, but look at the cars. Like, we were like, what?
Yeah.
So through my music research, Brad Bird is quoted by saying he was looking for the designer. He told the designer he wants to be designed the future as seen from the 1960s.
Yeah, that's what I thought. Mm-hmm. Somewhere in here I had retro future is sort of the way of referring to that aesthetic, that look.
It's like a what's it called? Hyperbole? What's it called?
I mean, yeah.
Skinny pole.
Retro future is an oxymoron?
Retro future is.
Oh, an oxymoron.
It is an oxymoron.
Gotcha. Yeah.
Is that what you were going for, Brian?
That was. Thank you.
Okay. Well, so I guess he sort of I'm like missing where exactly I wrote it down, but he sort of was inspired to have this look of the movie, the retro future look. Oh, there it is. By Johnny Quest, the old cartoon. Because he used to love Johnny Quest. So it matches that sort of aesthetic. And apparently the unusual angular architecture in the film was based on a distinctive style in the 1950s space age futurism known as Googie. Often seen in coffee shops, bowling alleys, and many contemporary homes of the era. Tiki architecture and other 50s pop styles, often considered a form of, maybe it's Guji. Maybe I'm saying it wrong. Guji.
I was going to say Guji.
Yeah.
Guji. Isn't that a Jack quote?
It's like Google with an I instead of an L. So,
okay. Yeah. Guji.
Yeah.
Guji. Guji. Guji sounds more posh.
Guji style.
Did you say where it? where it originated?
I'm just sort of assuming it's an American thing. It makes me think of like quintessential American 1950s kind of stuff. But no, it didn't. This quote I took down didn't say that.
Which also is very Iron Giant.
Totally.
You know, so it seems to be his thing.
That must be. Yeah, you're right.
Totally. Yeah, the style, like all the trapezoids, it's like the covers of cool jazz albums.
Exactly.
Yeah. I'm pretty sure the general in the Iron Giant is the same character like drawn as the like liaison to the government in the limo with them.
Oh, interesting.
It like instantly made me go, that's the general that's trying to fight the Iron Giant.
Okay, yeah, the guy, like the worn out FBI kind of guy or whatever, CIA
or something.
Yeah.
Anyway.
He originally, Brad Bird, originally conceived of this as a conventional cell animated film, which is like a 2D animation style when he pitched it. And then eventually the end credits still sort of have that originally intended cell shaded or cell animated style. So other random things. This is the first and thus far only Pixar movie to not feature a distinct appearance by the Pizza Planet truck from Toy Story.
Ah.
Really? Yeah. The only one? The only one so far.
Yeah, the only one so far. So if another movie comes out and doesn't feature it.
I mean, it's probably not in Brave.
I don't know.
I mean, I was thinking Cars.
It's definitely in Cars.
You guys are right. That's a good point. Brave, I didn't think of. I don't know.
Ratatouille. I mean, they could maybe put it in Ratatouille. 2D. Ratatouille. We'll get there.
We'll figure it out.
Yeah, but they did do some of the other traditions, like teasing the next Pixar film and having a character voiced by John Ratzenberger, which they almost didn't have. Like, they added that at the end. Well, at the maybe not the very end of the production process, but after the whole story had been fleshed out, he was like, oh, wait, I gotta put John Ratzenberger in there. So,
yeah. The Underminer!
Yeah. So, in the original.
John Ratzenberger wasn't showing up.
Yeah, exactly. You're like, wait, where's John? And then he pops up.
First part of the second movie.
Yep.
That's right. That's right.
The second movie starts up like right where this movie leaves off. And like, I was kind of surprised by that. Honestly, me too. All right, go ahead. Sorry.
It's good. In the original script, Syndrome, you know, the bad guy, only appeared in the opening scene. And then Pixar animators responded much more strongly to him than the main villain they originally intended, like Zurek or something like that. In the deleted scenes from the DVD, you can see like some of the like storyboard drawings for that sequence where Syndrome first like comes into their house. It was supposed to be the only scene he was in, and it's very like dark and creepy.
It's super dark. So we watched all the deleted scenes on YouTube, and I was like, I definitely watched these on the DVD because I was obsessed with this movie because it seemed really familiar. But the original movie was supposed to be like they just got married, like they just had their first baby, which was Violet. She's like a baby. And they're like just moved to this new neighborhood, like trying to assimilate to be like regular people. So they went to a backyard barbecue, and she's like meets this lady, and she's like, "What do you do?" She's like, "Oh, I'm a homemaker. Like, here's my baby." And the lady's all like, "Oh, you're just a homemaker. Like, boring, whatever." And Helen Parr gets all upset at her, like, "You don't think this is important, like?" I used to save people for my job, but I gave that up for a family. And like Brad Bird based that on his wife, who had like a really successful career in like the film industry, like him. And like, she gave it up to have kids and have a family. And like, she felt like left out at like parties and stuff. So he like based that on his wife and whatever, this whole thing goes crazy. They have to like leave the barbecue because they're going to get found out. And then they like go to bed at night. And Syndrome like breaks into their house, like, "Oh, you thought you could hide from me." And like, he hears the baby like crying, and he's like has him frozen in his little beams that he has in the movie. And he's like, "Oh, wait, Mr. Incredible married Elastigirl and had a baby." So it's like,
he does kind of say that in the movie.
It's exactly the same. Yeah. It's like the same scene that happens in the real movie later. So they took from that. But it's really creepy. He has him like frozen in his little finger things. And he like goes down the hallway to the baby. And he's like, I'm going to steal the baby. And like, yeah, it's like super dark, like helpless parents. And he wants their baby. And so they re like the, and we'll talk about it, the opening, real opening sequence in a little bit, but they agree that the opening sequence they did is better, but Brad Bird really liked the like creepiness of him like invading their house. So they put that at the end of the real movie when he comes in to get Jack-Jack. So they still kind of kept a lot of that in the movie still. So, all right. Sorry.
Yeah.
Back to Jimmy. Yeah, it's cool. You should watch that YouTube video.
Yeah. Animation wise, I guess clothing with its textures, weavings, and stitching is notoriously difficult to achieve in computer animation. So there was like tons of costumes in this movie. So like they spent a ton of time just animating the clothes. Like when Edna like tosses out the uniform and it looks all like very natural, like cloth, that took them so long to animate. And on some of the close-up shots, there's like tons of layers of like, what does it say? Well, fabrics and lighting and translucence and all this stuff when it's like a close up on the costumes. But other times, if it's like a faraway shot, it's just like a solid red or a solid whatever it is, because they just couldn't keep it up the whole movie. But I thought that was interesting. You wouldn't think it how hard it would be to animate. Speaking of that, it's also supposedly hard to animate like air and fire and water in movies, just like the way that characters interact with those different elements and the way they project light, like in the case of fire and everything. And like all of those elements are very heavily featured in the exploding of the airship scene.
Oh, yeah.
So, like there's a
giant... Especially like the lava from the volcanoes and things, totally. Whatever that fire is. Yeah.
Yeah. I love that set. That design is so awesome. Anyway, Frank and Ollie, two of the like nine old men from the olden days of Disney, voice the two old men that see them like take down the monster, and they're like,
at the end.
That's how it was in my day. I don't remember the line, but
yeah. So at the very beginning of the movie, when Mr. Incredible's like saving the cat, and like the cops show up, at the end of the movie, the two old guys that are like, no, that's how you do it. That's old school. Those are supposed to be the same cops, like older.
No school like the old school.
Yeah. Well, that's Frank and Ollie. That's and they're, cool. They've been another, apparently, like Monsters, Inc. as well.
No, I didn't know that.
Something else too. Maybe Iron Giant, I think. I don't know. The little kid who says, that was wicked, is the.
That was totally wicked.
That's Brad Bird's son, who also did the voice of Squirt, the little turtle in Finding Nemo.
Oh, I knew that. Yeah,
and his older son does the voice of Violet's crush, the like boy in the turtleneck.
Oh, like Brad. What's
Tony Reidinger.
Oh, nice.
She'd want to eat it if it was a Tony steak or something like that. When they're eating dinner. Yeah. Sorry, I know the quotes from this movie.
Yeah, I love that.
Yeah, that's good. The design of Syndrome and Bob, like the hero and the villain, are sort of based on Brad Bird's face. And if you see like a side-by-side comparison, you can totally see it, specifically in like Syndrome's kind of toothy grit, well, like the way his teeth are shaped. It's very similar to Brad Bird's face. So check that out if you get a chance.
Check out his teeth, guys.
Yeah, go check out his teeth. You could Google it right now.
Just did. Super crazy.
The guy who did, Jason Lee, by the way, who did Syndrome's voice, recorded his lines in just 4 days. And the guy who did Mr. Incredible was recording his vocals for over like 2 years, or over the span of 2 years.
Well, that could be because they were changing stuff a lot.
Yeah, I bet. Lily Tomlin, who you guys might know, the actress, was...
Say that again?
I said of Netflix's Grace and Frankie. I'm sorry. I'll shut up.
No, that's a great reference because I couldn't think of like a memorable like.
No, Grace and Frankie is brilliant.
Yeah,
and the most iconic reference I think is the voice of Miss Frizzle in the Magic School Bus TV series.
That's I didn't Lily know Tomlin. That.
Absolutely. She's also secretary, second secretary in West Wing.
Yes.
She's the equivalent of that in like a lot of movies.
And I'm sure way long before that, yeah. But
so she was considered to be the voice of Edna, but Brad Bird had done the vocal performance in like the early drafts, and Lily Tomlin was supposedly like, "What do you need me for? You already got it." And so they stuck with Brad Bird's vocals for Edna, which are like, you know, some of the best line recordings in the movie. He was listening to Public Radio International, and that's where he heard Sarah Vowell. She's a frequent contributor to the Public Radio International program, This American Life. And he liked her voice for Violet. And so he had to convince her by animating a sequence of like her recording from This American Life, but they like animated it to Violet to like sell her on the idea that she'd be perfect for this character. DC Comics objected to the name Elastigirl because they already have a character named Elastigirl, but there was a compromise where they said, and all the promotional outside of the film, including the promotional materials, the video games, everything else, Elastigirl would be known as Mrs. Incredible. So only in the film is she referred to as Elastigirl, I guess. Mirage, you know, the character, the like, you know, whatever she is, the lady.
She's like the manager, like she's like Syndrome's assistant.
Yeah, the assistant.
Covert assistant. I don't know.
I said she's the office manager of Syndrome's lab.
There you go.
What she is.
Mirage.
Office manager. She has a toll-free number on her calling card that's 866 whatever it is, which is an unregistered phone number at the time of the movie's original release. However, when compared to the letters on a typical phone pad, the last seven digits spell out the word superhero with no E. The phone number was active as of the DVD's release. It contained Mirage's voice directing you to the movie's website. It told you to input the phone number on the site to get access to secret information, including deleted scenes not included in the DVD. The requirement to enter the phone number was subsequently removed, and the phone number no longer works. I thought that was kind of a fun idea, though. I wish they still did things like that.
Yeah.
Anyway, that's all of the IMDb trivia facts for you guys. I saw several others on YouTube that as our discussion goes on, I might be like, oh, I saw this thing, but that's enough, I think.
No, that's cool. I definitely didn't know most of that stuff. I did know that Brad Bird was Edna mode. And when we like watched a video and they like showed him, Jimmy's like, what? That's so crazy.
Yeah, I didn't know.
Like, I don't know. I remember them specifically talking about that on like Disney Channel, like little ads they had when they were promoting this movie. Like, Brad Bird's playing this little woman. Isn't that Bunny Kids? Like, basically is what I feel like they were going for.
Yeah, I can't remember.
Anyway, so for our listeners out there, you can probably tell we've changed up our format slightly. So instead of just talking through the movie, we're going to do a very quick little synopsis of the storyline. We've already talked about it a little bit. And then we're going to have just some more main discussion points. So in case you need a refresher or you've never seen The Incredibles, this movie is about a family of superheroes. Mr. Incredible is the dad. He used to be like the best superhero out there. And he married another famous female superhero named Elastigirl. But their real names are Bob Parr and Helen Parr. They got married. Superheroes started to get a bad rap because they would like cause a lot of destruction and people got mad. And I think that's kind of interesting considering how in like all the Marvel movies and like other superhero movies, they make so much destruction, but like they don't really talk about it that much. So all the superheroes are forced to go in hiding. They have to assimilate to regular life. So they get married, they make a family, they have three children. They have their daughter, Violet, their son, Dash, and their newer baby, Jack-Jack. Bob Parr works as an insurance claim specialist, and he wants to help people, but his boss is very pushy about making sure people don't get the claims they want, but he does his best to help them out, and his boss doesn't like that, so one day they get in a tiff, and he gets fired, but he doesn't tell his wife, and he secretly goes out to listen to police scanners with his buddy, Frozone. What's Frozone's real name?
Oh, I don't know.
Do they even call him Lucius? Lucius. Yeah, that's it.
You got it.
Lucius. I knew I had it. They listen to Police Scanners because they still want to help people. And he's just not very happy. And this secret secret agent Mirage comes and says, hey, you want superhero life back? Come work for me. So he goes to this island. He doesn't know who he's working for, but he gets paid a ton of money. Life gets better. But one day he gets trapped on this island and there's a new villain in town named Syndrome, who is out for vengeance against Mr. Incredible because he didn't want him to be his sidekick when he was a kid. And apparently Brad Bird based that idea off of like, well, what if Batman just like didn't want Robin as a sidekick? Like, what if he just was like, nope, sorry, Robin, don't like you. What would Robin have done? So that's kind of where he got that idea. Anyways, he gets stuck on this island and Helen Parr, his wife, since he's been keeping this whole thing a secret, thinks that he's like cheating on her. So she decides to go after him and the kids stow away on this plane. They go to the island and the whole family has to work together with their superheroes to save Mr. Incredible from the island and then save all of the people from the city from this big, massive, dangerous robot that Syndrome created. And Syndrome thinks he can handle everything. His idea is anyone can be super because I could just make all this fancy stuff and I can fly and I can do all these things. But, you know, at the end of the day, maybe you really need someone a little super. So there's your quick little synopsis of the story. So I do want to open up our discussion first by just talking about the whole opening sequence. We kind of talked about this with Finding Nemo, how like super well made the opening sequence of, you know, Finding Nemo is with Coral dying and how that really sets up Marlin's character. Of course, there's a bunch of other great opening sequences, but I really like this one. I really like the way they sort of capture this superhero, like you said, alternate universe time they're in, and set up what it was like in the quote unquote glory days, as they refer to it in the movie. And then we cut to, you know, what life is like now for them. So, any thoughts on that opening sequence, Jimmy?
I mean, the opening sequence is great as far as, I think in one of the things I saw, they were talking about how they specifically chose that to like subvert the audience's expectations as far as it being like a, you know, an incredible superhero movie. And just make everybody focus on the characters as characters instead of as these flashy superheroes. And I think it really works well. It does like, I mean, it also encapsulates some of the themes as far as like the mundane meets the incredible, where like he specifically says like, oh, I can break through walls, but I can't put this microphone on. So, you know, I think it sets up the tone of the movie really well. It does sort of subvert your expectations in a good way. And I think it's really pretty genius.
Was a better opening sequence than Pixar, like historically, right? Like, it's like the most stereotypical in a good way thing I think about like favorite Pixar movies is like a good opening sequence that like really draws you in and also gives you years and years and years of, you know, exposition in 5 to 7 minutes, you know what I mean? And like super entertaining. And then it starts off the movie and you already really feel like you know what's going on. I mean, like another example is like Up. You know what I mean? It's like, they've always really figured that part of their films out, and I think that this is like one of the first examples of it.
Yeah, for me, it was very refreshing. I thought I was going to watch a superhero movie, you know, but then it changes, and it was very interesting that the government were opposed to the superheroes and, you know, kind of these adult themes happening. But I was excited to go for the ride even more that now we're not superheroes. So excellent.
And then they're reintroduced as not superheroes, but as like a familial aspect of it, you know, and it's like it actually begins.
I'll add one thing, because I'm glad I was able to rewatch this while able to pause it and rewind certain scenes. But if you can see the audience for the wedding scene, if you take a look at all the various superheroes in costume that are at that scene, all come up later in the movie.
Yeah.
Yeah, that is true. I didn't notice that this time, but I've definitely noticed that in the past. I also think it's fun how, like, the first time you watch it, you know, they're like, they run into each other, like, on the town, like, beating crime, and they're being all playful, and then you don't, and then you're like, oh, they're about to get married.
Yeah, you assume that they're just like, they're just like flirting or whatever.
Yeah.
It's like setting up the whole thing. You didn't realize that this actually was like their wedding day.
Yeah.
I love how in like the opening part when they're like in the interviews, when he's just like, I feel like the maid, like I just cleaned up this mess. Like, can you just keep it safe for 5 minutes? And then he like laughs and gets up like he's about to like leave.
Yeah.
And then the interviewer's like, no, we're not done. Yeah. And it like guts back to him. That part always cracks me up.
The interview frame is good. That's always a good expositionary frame.
Yeah.
To get a character to talk about themselves. I appreciate that in an exposition.
I think it's interesting how they end on it missing Incredibles line of like, they say something like, do you see yourself settling down anytime soon or something? And she's like, oh God, no, not a chance or something like that. And that's like the last quote we hear.
She says like, leave the saving to the men. Come on, ladies. I don't think so.
And she sort of like has a reflective look the second time she says, I don't think so. And then it turns out she, of course, is just like the mom, you know, and, you know, she does get back to fighting. And then the second movie comes.
Yeah, I was going to say.
And it's really all about her, like, you know, midlife crisis kind of.
Well, no, it all goes back to that. Like her whole thing, like, I want to be the woman out there fighting crime, like, you know, girl power.
Right.
Then they took that and like made that sort of the basis of the sequel, which is kind of cool.
It is cool.
Jacob, anything you want to add?
You guys have nailed it. Yeah. I mean, it's 5 to 7 minutes of perfect funneling to the story. And, you know, it's how you're supposed to corral an audience when you're telling a story. So it's perfect.
All right. So this goes into the next point of discussion, which is just the overall animation style, which Jimmy talked a lot about that in his fun facts. Something cool that we saw when we were watching some YouTube videos was that this movie had like 30 something sets or was it even more? I don't exactly remember the number, but let's just call it like 35 sets. Whereas like
Finding Nemo
only had like 12 or something like that. Like all the backgrounds, all the places they go was like a lot of work for them. Which I never really thought about animation like that, like sets. And so I love the credits of this movie. I always watch them. And there's one part where they have the word sets super big and like the one person in charge of sets name. And I was like, I wonder what sets means. Like, who even is that? What's their job? And then when they talked about it in the little documentary we watched, I was like, wow, like that looks like so much work. And like, no wonder they like gave them a whole screen in the credits for their work.
I mean, like, beyond it just being a lot of work and like a huge undertaking, it's executed so well.
Well, yeah. And the whole theme and style you talked about, the retro future is so very specific and the colors. Totally. I think that overall, like, island is just a really cool, very cool design of the island they go to.
I remember, like, as a kid, like, being, like, awestruck by that weird tram thing, you know?
Yeah.
Like, that's one of those things we also talked about, like, when we were talking about Monsters, Inc., that, like, you're always like, oh, like, when are they going to make that a ride? You know, and that was probably like what I wanted to be like. The ride was like in that orb thing that they like fly around. Oh my God, I thought that was so cool.
Yeah, that's got like, it's a very like, got a lot of what am I trying to say? It's definitely got a people mover vibe, like from Disneyland.
Sure.
Like, it's the monorail meets the people mover.
It's really OG Tomorrowland.
Yeah.
Yeah.
The whole thing.
Yeah, talk about like retro future. Like that's exactly what I think of when I think of the original Tomorrowland from the 50s in Disneyland. One of the biggest things about the animation in this movie is that this is the first Pixar movie where all the characters are human. And they finally, they had to nail this idea of like, how do we animate these humans to where it's believable? It's not too cartoony. Like, you believe that they're humans. And, you know, I think it's interesting that they finally moved away from animals and toys when this new director came in.
Yeah, I think there's multiple factors at play. I think they weren't able to animate humans as convincingly for a while. I mean, specifically with like Mr. Incredible, they sort of show in some of the behind the scenes things we were watching about how he has like a skeleton and then like a musculature and then like a skin on top of that, just in terms of his model to make his movements look natural and all, and you know, the muscles move as he flexes them and whatnot. So yeah, I just think partly, like, if you think back to Toy Story, which did have humans, how like Sid and his sister look in that movie, or even Andy and his mom, you know, they're kind of like, oh, okay, like early computer animation. In this movie, they're certainly more stylized. I guess they're in Dory too, or Nemo too, actually, with the dentist and Darla. But yeah, I think they, I think in a way they were kind of like ready to do it now, technology wise.
I also think it's interesting how they base both Mr. Incredible and Syndrome on Brad Bird. And I feel like a lot of the people in this movie have a very similar look to them. And it's like everyone's Brad Bird, except for like Elastigirl, except for the main female characters, obviously have a very different look to them.
No, it's really good. Well, I think that this, one of the important things about their animating humans, particularly compared to how things have advanced in the 15 years since, is like, the style, like they kind of rely on the style for ways that they couldn't make things totally realistic. They still have, people still have that angular style and the proportions and stuff. So where they couldn't like make it totally realistic, they can make it at least work with a certain style, and they figured out how to do that. And even that is like really impressive.
Yeah, because it sort of looks real in some ways, but it's also totally not real and cartoony. The way they look, I mean, the way they're designed. But you still, like, their hair has a very sort of realistic look, at least Violet's in particular. And that's all things that they didn't have the technology for back in Toy Story's day or even Bug's Life's day.
Yeah, being able to get hair was definitely an advancement.
Yeah.
Well, and they, like, they were, like, in scenes where they had wet hair. The hair was in different states on each character. It was, totally. It was impressive.
Well, it's really good. That's one of the great things about the movie was that the style and the music that was, that fit the style to like.
Yeah.
Well, in my opinion, it wasn't very good human animation. It looked more like animation versus when I would watch A Bug's Life or Finding Nemo, for example, where it looked very real and I could put myself in that world. But the humans were, you know, cartoon versions of humans. So I was not that impressed with this particular animation in that respect.
What do you think about like the coloring and the textures and stuff though, besides the humans?
Well, one of the most impressive scenes I felt was the scenes of the island. They were beautiful and graphic, and I could believe I was there. Otherwise, it looked like cartoons to me.
Yeah, I think they were definitely going for like a cartoony vibe, but also as real as possible in terms of like the scenery. Yeah.
I think a lot of that had to do with the fact that this is like the first time humans are dying. So they didn't want to make it too real. I mean, they wanted to make it real, like texturization and all those kind of things, which I think they did. But, you know, Mr. Incredible couldn't fit through a normal doorway. Like, you know, things like that.
Right.
Like, they're just kind of accentuating what they're about. And I think that's fine.
Part of it is part of the, like, comic book nature of, like, the whole superhero thing. But I think Daniel was right on, too, when he was like, they were limited into as to how realistic they could actually make these humans look. So they kind of just like leaned into the caricature,
yeah,
or the cartoony sort of design instead of trying to go hyper realistic. But they do go hyper realistic with the textures and sort of the natural elements in the, like the jungle and stuff is very,
right,
very realistic looking, and the water and all of that. So yeah, the lava, like we said earlier. I mean, that set is just so great. And Edna's place is so well designed. I mean, yeah, I didn't think about it as much, maybe, or like consciously as much until this most recent viewing, just how cool some of those sets are. Even their house.
Edna's is house really cool. Is cool. Yeah, their house too.
They were talking about it in one of the behind the scenes, the sort of retro future look of it, or the 60s look. And they show like a still of their house. And it's like a cool design. Even on the interior, it kind of looks nice and that 60s vibe. It's really cool.
The boss's office is cool too.
Yes.
Just his desk and him doing his pencils on the calendar.
Right, and the way they make it that things. Gray color tone to sort of reflect the like banal, depressing nature of his life. Yeah.
Yeah. Cubicle. Yeah. And even like, I remember thinking like the dust looks cool when they're on the island and like the, you know, saw whatever ship things that the bad guys use.
Yeah.
And the dust, you could see them through the dust. Like it wasn't like Tasmanian devil dust. It was just dust.
Yeah.
Like a helicopter or something. So,
yeah.
Yeah.
So it's
or like that scene when Dash like runs really fast and the dust kicks up.
Yeah. Yes, yeah.
And then
I remember
seeing
that.
Her like little orb face, force field, whatever.
Oh, yeah. That's like cool.
I think all of what we're talking about, all of those realistic looking elements sort of add to what my mom was pointing out, that the humans really don't look super realistic, and maybe the juxtaposition is kind of why they look. Yeah.
When I think about classic comic books, you know, Dick Tracy or somebody, that they looked more human than this movie.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. I mean, you're right. They weren't like exaggerated, like giant bulging chest, like super skinny waist, like all of that. You're right. They looked much more natural in those old comic books.
I think that I agree with what you're saying, that they don't look like real humans, but I still really like the style of this movie and the style of the humans they have. And I think they did a great job, like you're saying, animating their skin, the way their muscles move, the way their hair looks. Like Violet's hair was like a whole process of animating. Like,
yeah,
I just like the way it looks a lot.
And
like,
some
it's
of the
pleasing
early
to
footage,
look at.
Oh, sorry, I didn't mean to talk.
Sorry, no, you're ahead. Go ahead.
No, and some of the early footage, like very early, where they're just like doing the character models and they haven't added all the textures and stuff. Like the mom will still have her basic hair shape on her head, and I think most of them do. But Violet's just like a bald head. Because they were just like waiting until the hair was ready to like be applied, you know. It's just, it was like a whole separate endeavor to get that hair to look right. So yeah,
well, it's part of her character, that's why. I mean, it makes sense.
Yeah,
at least they used it, you know, like it's not just like jerking off, we can do this. It's like was part of her character that she got it away from her face eventually, and that kind of thing.
So one of the main themes of this movie is the juxtaposition between like a mundane, boring life and the fantastic, right? Being a superhero. And I think they play into that really well. Like we were saying from like the opening sequence, like look how great the quote unquote glory days were in superheroes. And then it's 15 years later and, you know, Mr. Incredible is this big overweight guy. His face, like that first scene when you see him like at work, he looks so run down and depressed. He's so out of it. And well, it's just like, how could, like, we all
he
can
has
relate.
He squeezed into his car.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Like, oh, yeah, exactly. Well, because, I mean, that the real theme going on there is that it's about the midlife crisis. You know, that's the main plot. It's this guy who's, you know, struggling with, like, losing his testosterone in middle age and dealing with, like, you know, his masculinity is being squeezed into a smaller box, and that's his whole thing, and he's pushing against it. And it's, well, I mean, that's one of the themes of the movie anyway. And then,
yeah.
Oh,
Well, when he takes on the contract with the girl who I can never remember her name, the sexy
Mirage.
Girl. Mirage.
Yes.
Is she really there?
And he's like losing weight and he's got the new car and it's like the middle life crisis dream, you know.
All of that fucking train.
Yeah.
Yeah, dude.
That whole scene is like the Pixar montage scene, you know, like every Pixar movie has the musical montage scene. That's it. When he's like working out and he got the money and he got his car.
Forward. So good.
And that music, what's the word? That orchestration, that part of the movie is called The Glory Days. And that was the second movement of The Incredibles Field Show that Daniel
did. It was called Life's Incredible Again. Life is the name of that movement.
The Glory Days.
You're right.
Life's Incredible Again. Well, they're like incredible very again. Similar. Oh, no, I guess I'm just wrong. Never mind. Go ahead. Who was talking?
Oh, we were all kind of chiming in about the theme of the mundane juxtaposed. Oh, I actually took a little quote of Brad Bird sort of mentioning that explicitly, which is why I recorded it. And he sort of mentions one scene in particular that illustrates that I'll let you guys hear. Hopefully you can hear it over the mic. We'll see.
Floating and people hugging. So it's those two elements, sort of the mundane and the fantastic, kind of sharing screen space. Those notes make up this movie, like Helen being in the bad guy's base in her super suit, and she can't help when she passes in front of a mirror, stopping and kind of checking out how her suit's fitting with that very critical eye that women have on their own bodies.
So yeah, just another scene that illustrates this from, you know, the man himself. Yeah. Which is like a whole like joke in like memes about like we might have to edit this out, but like it's something about like, you know, you've been on the internet too long when you're like jerking off to Pixar mom butts or something like that. I don't know. I thought it was really funny.
And also, you know who also has a big fucking ass is the girl from Inside Out's mom.
Yeah, it's not just Missing Incredible. It's like a thing. I think Andy's mom probably too.
Yes, Andy's mom had a big ass.
Yes, it's so funny.
Right, those ants, big asses.
What about? Oh god.
What does that say?
Big butts in Monsters Inc.
Well, they're all monsters and weird shaping. So,
but then somebody should have a monster butt.
Well, yeah. What's her name? Celia had some curves going on for sure.
Roz.
Her slug tail.
What does that say about these animators that like are mostly male?
What do you think?
Mama's boys.
I'm just putting that. I'm just throwing that question out there. The listeners can chew on that as they want.
Yeah.
You away, all two of you.
We have more than two.
What's up, John? Ooh. No.
Yeah.
What's up? We got three. What's up, John? What's up, Chris? What's up, Cactus?
Yeah. Why do you think Brad Bird likes big butts? Can he lie?
Can he lie?
Can he lie?
Can he lie? Oh my god. But yeah, the mundane versus the fantastic. I do think it's interesting too how,
not even versus, but like, well, together.
Well, sure. But that whole montage, we got very off topic, but that whole montage about him like working out and like bringing home the bacon and all that stuff. That whole time he finally feels like he's got his life back, and Helen is still just like vacuuming the house every day and doing the laundry every day.
And he has to keep his joy away from her.
Yeah.
He like, can't. It's, yeah. But it's like the working out and, you know, being a superhero, that's what everybody wants in their midlife crisis, right? So he's got the epitome of the best. And then even the best situation crumbles.
Don't you guys feel like he's cheating? Like almost like it feels like he's cheating on his wife, kind of. That's
well,
that
yeah, that's a whole part of the movie. Like, She thinks he is.
It's like the Disney version of it, you know.
Well, and sure. He's flirting with Mirage. Like, there's not nothing there.
I think that I don't like to think that they ever were more than just painful office flirting.
Right.
But, no, they definitely didn't. But she, and I think that Bob, like, totally loves his wife and kids and, like, was never actually thinking that. He was just, you know, having a little fun. But Mirage, like, definitely has a crush on him. Like, she is.
She was digging that I could crush you moment. She was digging it.
He looks bomb.
Charged with the sexual energy. That's
body audio.
Definitely charged.
Yeah.
Definitely charged.
But going back to the cheating on you thing, which was another theme I wanted to talk about, so we can just kind of do that now. You know, the other big theme, which is, you know, being a normal person, being a mom, being a dad, being a family, being a teenage girl, and having superpowers. And, like, how would that really affect you and in your life? And Helen thinks that he's cheating on her for sure. And they actually cut out two scenes that were more about that. And one of the scenes, going back to what I said about her, like, the vacuuming, and, you know, she's still living the mundane life, but he got his whole midlife crisis figured out for a short time. There's a scene they cut out where she is dream sequence, and she's, like, doing the laundry and, like, cleaning up in the backyard, and, like, he's just, like, hanging out with all these chicks, like, showing off how strong he is, and she's, like, tries to go over to, like, be like, hey, get off my husband, but then the laundry, like, turns into a monster and, like, grabs her and pulls her. And they were talking about, like, yeah, that was definitely the first scene we cut out, like, when we had to start making cuts. They were like, yeah, you know, the classic dream sequence.
Yeah, he was talking about how dream sequences like that are sort of like shortcuts to showing you what's going on inside a character.
Uh-huh.
And so, yeah, they ultimately decided they didn't want to take that sort of shortcut. And they didn't need to. They did. They showed her struggles.
Yeah,
it would have worked. Decision. It would have worked, they though.
Got the information across efficiently, I think.
Yeah,
I think they made that point.
Totally, I think a lot of that is
the acting, though. Too, they probably needed that, and if they had a lesser person in that role.
Could be. I mean, he said that it was specifically in part of the story early on, and it was one of the earlier things to get cut. He kind of knew it. Like, he put it in the movie knowing that it might get cut. It's just sort of a way to explain to everybody as you're, like, giving birth to this movie and showing it to everybody, to show to them what's going on in her mind. And he knew eventually they might find other ways to say that.
There's actually then also... I think they do a really good job of, like, you being in Helen's shoes and, like, especially as a woman, just like, oh, like, she thinks he's cheating on her. Like, you feel it too, even though you know he's not. But I mean, in a way he is, because he's not being totally honest with her. But there actually is a whole scene where Helen goes in and confronts him in his little, like, man cave where his, like, super suit is. And she's like, straight up goes, like, what's this blonde hair? Like, are you cheating on me? I don't think she says the exact line, are you cheating on me? But she does say, she confronts him about it. And he goes, like, what? Like, I can't, like, just, you know, I wanted to have my own little life. Like, I miss the glory days or whatever. And it's, like, was a little too serious for a Pixar movie. And I'm really glad they cut it out. But yeah, it's, like, totally a theme. Very adult.
It is adult, but I mean, it reaches across all ages in terms of loyalty, lying, fidelity.
I think
kids can understand if someone's lying or not telling the truth or someone's suspicious, but I didn't do it, you know. Somebody didn't really do the wrong thing. So I think it hits a lot of chords for kids.
Yeah, I think kids can understand that when somebody lies, the ramification isn't just that they're lying, but that other people's imaginations can make it worse. So he was lying. He wasn't lying about having an affair, but that's where her mind went instantly. I think kid, at least, like, I don't know, 12-year-olds can understand that, that the damage a lie can do beyond what the lie is about.
I think even younger kids just sort of recognize when adults or specifically parents aren't getting along, and they might not really know why or what it's about, or like the whole context of like, oh, she thinks he was like being with other women and cheating on her. They don't understand that concept, but they see the tension. They're familiar with it. They've seen it in other movies. They've maybe seen it in their own house, and they get the emotional response that you're supposed to get without even knowing really why they're having that argument.
So. And they include it in the movie. The kids are part of, like, they sneak in to listen to the argument. Like, we've all done, you know, trying to figure out if who's in trouble, who's not in trouble. Am I in trouble? You know, all those kind of things kids do when the adults are talking. And it just so happens they're better at it because one's super fast and one's invisible. But, I mean, even those parents get it. They like can feel when their kids are present, and it's the same thing we all went through of just like, we're just discussing things in a, you know, a heated way that you can't understand.
Yeah. A really good thing about this movie, however, is that it shows us that, you know, Bob isn't really guilty, even though she has every right to be suspicious when they go to their quote bowling night, you know, and he's out late and then things are unexplainable. And so we're already rooting for Bob. You know, we don't want her to be jealous, but we love her too. That is such good writing. Yeah. That character development is such that we see both perspectives. I honestly don't know if a young child would, but nonetheless, as an adult, we see both perspectives and understand it. You know, and then things get more complicated, right? Because Bob's lies result in him going off to God knows, you know, to that crazy, what's that called, that island?
Called an island.
I don't know.
No, I looked it up. No man is an island.
Yeah.
No man is on. Ooh.
No man's island. No.
No.
No man is on. No man is on.
Is island.
No man is island.
Oh, no man is an island.
No man is an island. Yeah, that's what it's okay.
It's one of the themes, actually.
Yeah,
it's one of the themes.
Anyways,
but musical themes. Okay, sorry.
Yeah.
No, nothing. I was just repeating the fact that I think that's such good writing that both characters elicit our empathy, our understanding, and yet we also are able to understand how the other spouse could be as suspicious as they are.
Mm-hmm.
Good stuff.
And they set up a history, right? Have you been listening to the police scanner again? Like, so she is more suspicious because it's weirder than it's happened before, because he's done this with his Lucius before, you know, the bowling night. They listen to the police scanner, they do things. So she's known about it being a thing, but now it's like, you know, way more suspicious, and he's gone on these trips that he never did before with work. So I think, I mean, there's a depth, like what you're saying, Cynthia, that the storytelling, the level is very high.
There's also the depth of the fact that apparently this is true of like all the other superheroes, right? Because of the whole plot line, the syndrome had to go through like 30, kill like 30 other superheroes. So he was able to figure out that this was like a theme among superheroes, that they were struggling to adjust to mundane life among not being super, and that they were desperate to get back out and be super, and that he was able to exploit that. And that I mean, that's not something that I totally pick up on the first viewing, that like it has this as like a huge broad theme that it must be going on among a lot of people.
Well, they even say that when Bob like throws his boss like through the walls at work and he gets fired, and then the CIA guy or whoever comes, he's like, we can't keep doing this, Bob. I can't do this again. Like, you know, and he says, you know, Kaser Beam had trouble adjusting to life too. Like he even says, I think it's Kaiser being one of them at the beginning, you know, and how that is a theme when Bob goes to the island and he realizes Kaiser Beam is dead. Oh no, he's reading a newspaper and sees it. Like it's Kaiser Beam's real name, which I can't remember, but so-and-so longtime proponent of superhero rights is missing. And that's when Bob goes, Kaiser Beam? And then we find out later at the island, he like sees a skeleton and he's one of the ones that Syndrome has killed.
I didn't put that together at all.
Oh, really?
That it was that.
Oh, you... really? Yeah.
Yeah.
Yeah. Also, going back to the like kids, you know, understanding the adultery theme, there is a scene. I just want to point out.
Yes.
Because I like this scene so much because it's when they, you know, Elastigirl and her kids are at the island. The plane gets knocked down. Bob and Syndrome think they're dead, but they're not. They swim to the island. They like go to the cave or whatever. And she's like, I'm going to go look for your dad. And she leaves. And it's just Violet and Dash. And Dash is like, oh, this is boring. I want to explore whatever. And she's like, will you take this seriously? Our parents' lives are in danger, or worse, their marriage. Like, oh, she knows it. She says it. And Dash, because she's the older sister, you know, and Dash is like, their marriage, like, nah, you know. But I just think it's interesting, like, they even put that in there, like, from that kid's perspective of, like, oh, my God, are my parents going to get a divorce? You know, like, every kid has that fear at some point, you know, in their childhood.
Yeah, even if they don't understand the intricacies of cheating and suspicion and all of that, they can just see tension and they just know, like, oh no, I don't want that. They know that divorce is a thing. They know that your parents, kids know that if their parents get in a bad enough argument, they might get divorced. Like, it's a somewhat of a fear that I think all kids have on some levels. For some kids, it's like a tiny pebble that, because it's so unlikely from their experience, but, just as a kid.
They have like a uniquely close relationship with their parents because they have such a big secret together.
Yeah.
And so I think like there's that other element that the marriage is like a given and the boy is now like, wait, that's not a given. Like the whole idea is that they have to stay together to survive because people would single them out and, you know, all those kind of things. They're kind of on the run. Like that's the whole thing. And the family, everybody knows it except for Jack. So yeah, I get that it. There's another, that other level.
Yeah. It adds another level to it. That's true.
Yeah. So, I mean, we've talked about the whole marriage theme and family theme, but now I want to specifically talk about this, the parenting idea. And like in this same scene, well, let me go back a little bit. So the scene when Helen's flying them to the island, she doesn't know the kids are on the plane yet. I don't know. She finds out they're there. Then they send the missiles and she's like, abort, abort, like trying to get them not to. That scene is very stressful, by the way. Like,
yes,
very stressful. And, you know,
she's begging Violet to use her superpower.
She's like, you have to put a force field around this plane now. Like, she's just like, well, we're not supposed to use our powers, you know, and she's trying to do it. And I'm just like, oh my God, I can't even imagine that as like the kid, but also the mom, like, oh my God, I don't want my kids to die. What do I do? Like that scene. Yeah. It's very, I think that scene does a really good job of, you know, it's still a Pixar movie. You know, everything's probably going to be fine. Like
Pixar really will go there. You know, like that's actually scary. And like, but then it turns into one of my favorite parts where it like blows up and you see just like the falling rubble in the sky. And then you just see her as the parachute holding the kids. And you're like, oh, yes.
She's like trying to console them, like as they're falling, like it's okay. Or I can't remember what she's saying, but like there's like fire behind her.
No, that's the end you're thinking of. Oh, that's Jack.
Oh, okay, never mind.
Oh,
it's a very she does. No, the
she
same
grabs
thing.
Them. They get in the water though, and Dash is like, "We're dead. We're gonna die." And she like hits the water in their face, and she's like, "You're not gonna die. Will you get a hold of yourself, or so help me? I will ground you for a month." Like. Grounding them even matters right now.
Actually, I wasn't even really aware of Elastigirl's, you know, special skills of what she could do. And so that scene was sort of the beginning of it. And of course, from there on out, it's marvelous how she can squeeze behind things and stop a train and pull this and lock that and, you know, stretch out her arm to get through a lock. But that scene where she, you know, she becomes a parachute or something was you know, revelatory, a revelation.
Well, and then literally, she turns into a boat and then Dash uses his fast legs. Like, that's so unfair.
I always thought that was so unfair because Violet just got to sit there.
Yeah.
And ride. I mean, she did save everybody's life, I guess, with the force field.
She didn't, though. She
not
didn't
yet.
Do the force
field. Up until this point, she has the seemingly most useless power.
Well, doesn't she make the force field, though, and that's what saves them? And then that's why they don't
No, the plane does blow up. She doesn't do it. And Elastigirl just, moves them out of there.
They justify it with when she's getting her suit that it can withstand rockets. So she just extended herself around her children.
Yeah.
Oh, like I never thought about it like that. Yeah.
Yeah, basically. Or tinfoil.
Yeah, or like a condom.
What?
If you're allergic to latex, you cannot be around Elastigirl.
Elastic.
Well.
Yeah, does she even have bones?
They probably are stretchy.
Yeah, I mean, how else does she have a big ass?
Is this where we go down the rabbit hole of trying to figure out the science of how it
really hope that we keep revisiting the Pixar dump truck ass moms throughout the day.
That's somebody's job to research the asses in Pixar.
Honestly,
wait, Kelly, I'm going to ignore this current conversation. How is it, I can't remember, how is it they get there onto the island and everyone gets captured?
So, okay. Real quick before I answer that question, the comment I want to make about the parenting theme. After the plane blows up, she's like stressing out Violet before she goes and before the scene where I said Violet's like, their marriage is in danger. She's like, I'm going to go find your dad. You're going to stay here. And she's like,
oh, right.
She's like, you guys have to be, she's like, if anything bad happens, you have to use your powers. And she's like, but I thought she's like, I know what I said. This is not like the TV shows you watch. These guys will kill you if they get the chance. She says that like, they're going to kill you. And I just was like, when you're first watching the movie, that kind of, you're just like, yeah, they might. It's a superhero movie. But if you think about that, like a mom telling their kids, like, you might get killed right now. And I'm telling you to stay hidden and use your superpowers so that you don't die. Like,
yeah,
it's just like,
I think we usually see that moment in movies between the dad and son. But in this moment, it's between the mother and the daughter. Yeah. Essentially, she's telling the older sister to take care of her younger brother.
You know what, Kelly? I remember as a mother saying to my sons and daughter as well, don't you ever start a fight, but if you're in one, you better freaking end it. You know what I mean? That it was just true. Like, okay, so if you don't have to promote violence, but if you have no other options, you better defend yourself. So that's what that reminded me of when she said, you know, whatever it takes, guys, use what you've got.
Yeah. Totally.
Maybe I'm a vigilante.
But to go back to your question, Cynthia, they get captured because so Dash is like going down that cave and the rocket goes off. And so they have to run away from the cave. So they're out in the forest now. Elastigirl sneaking around trying to find Bob. And then they get out. Anyways, they all run up into each other in the forest. And that's when we get this super cool action scene. This is probably one of my favorite parts of the movie. Like, Dash is running through the forest. He can find out.
My favorite.
He can run on water. And, like, Violet like tries to protect him. She finally starts learning how to like use her force field. He like runs in her little force field bubble. Then they run into mom and dad. And then we get that super cool scene when they're like, look, mom and dad, we're here. Like, you know, then they all start fighting together. It's like the first scene of them fighting as a family. That's when Dash does the thing. I don't know. It's super cool. And then Syndrome shows up and he like just freezes them all in his little finger zappers. He's like, what? A whole family of supers. What? Elastigirl? You married Elastigirl? What? And got busy.
Yeah. Yeah.
Anyways, that's how they all get trapped. He finally gets them. And then, yeah, he puts them in their little, like, binder thingies. And they're trapped in the his lair, I guess you want to call it. So.
Yeah, no, that scene is the best. I mean, I guess we'll get to that later. But, my goodness. It's so.
But there are so many cool action scenes in this. Like, going back to the animation discussion, like, they did such a cool job animating the explosions, animating Dash's running.
And yeah, dude, Pixar had not done action before, really, like this.
Yeah, that's a good point. Yeah.
This full on action, action sequences. Like,
so cool.
Totally.
Right.
Gosh, I was going to say something. Oh, like several of the action sequences, like especially like the final battle with a robot at the end, they did not, or Brad Bird did not like specify in the screenplay or maybe even the storyboarding like exactly how that scene would play out, knowing that in, throughout the course of animating it, they would come up with better ideas to sort of flesh it out and just be like, oh, well, what if this happened? And so he just didn't even bother sort of piece by piece or shot by shot figuring it out. But that scene in the forest with Dash running was one that he specifically did have in mind exactly how he wanted everything to play out. So I think that might factor into why it's so good. Like, it was part of his original vision for it. And, you know, he had that original vision and saw it through. And I'm sure they fine tuned it over time. But I thought that was an interesting point.
Jimmy or Daniel or Jacob, do you remember why is it that this movie reminded me of Sonic the Hedgehog? But when was Sonic the Hedgehog? Like before? Or
yeah.
After, way before.
Yeah, probably like 90s.
Game? Like 90s.
Okay.
Yeah, yeah. That was early mid 90s.
And five, it could just six, be, it just could be because, you know, I'm older, obviously, and didn't live through all the generations of Sonic and animation and everything, but it just reminded me of a little, you know, a little creature just running as fast as it could all over the place and all kinds of things happening. So by that time, totally, though, video games were much more sophisticated, I'm assuming.
2004, yeah. Definitely.
Yeah, that scene was also totally reminiscent of the speeder chase in Return of the Jedi. I'm sure they watched that a couple times.
Yeah. I mean, anytime I see a chase scene in a forest, it gives me
vibes. Right.
I was like, what? I was trying to, yeah, the forest scene.
Jungle, yeah. Whatever. But yeah.
Yeah. The moon of Endor.
Well, we've already very widely established that the Pixar creators love Star Wars. It's pretty obvious. So the last theme I wanted to talk about was just Pixar's overall interpretation of superheroes.
Yeah. There's a lot of different ways you could go with this. But one thing that I know, I mean, it makes me think a little bit like this movie on some level is saying that like some people are better than others, which isn't wrong necessarily, but it's sort of a controversial statement. Whereas Finding Nemo was so focused on people with special needs or, you know, their specialness is something that could be perceived as a weakness, like the special fin or.
But it's just something to be proud of.
Right, exactly. Yeah. But with Incredibles, it's like some people are truly incredible, but all that really matters is family. Like, you know, they're still going for like, all that really matters is family. Like, that's the heart of everything, I think. But yeah,
so
subliminal message that like some people are super and other people's aren't. And even, what's his name?
I'm glad you brought this up, yeah. Jimmy, because this is like my one issue.
I was going to say.
which I didn't realize till later, that some people have pointed out, like the reminiscent of like Nietzsche and Ayn Rand politics of the movie, that there are like super people who deserve to be super and are better and stuff. And apparently I found out Brad Bird has like denied that he was influenced by this stuff and says that's not it. But I mean, yeah, people point to things like the conversation where Bob doesn't want to go to Dash's graduation because he thinks that like the graduationing from fourth grade to fifth grade is like stupid. It's not a real graduation. They don't recognize someone who's truly exceptional. And then like Syndrome is like the villain because he's not exceptional and wants to like equalize the playing field, and that makes him the villain. And so people have pointed these things out as like being part of a real, like real hierarchical view of the world and into like those kind of political things. But Brad Bird has denied those claims, and it's a little more complicated, but that's one of the main issues with the movie. Apparently like some right wing and conservative circles have claimed the movie is like a right wing values movie.
Ugh.
But Brad Bird has denied it.
I don't think it was intentional. I think it sort of comes with the territory with superheroes, which is part of what makes Watchmen such an interesting piece of work, because it really kind of delves into like the responsibility of superheroes.
Version of Watchmen are you referring to?
Well, I guess all of them, but the comic and the HBO series the most. So but yeah, and like the HBO series even takes it to the like racial point in a heavy way. But yeah, sorry, I could go on, but I totally agree with you, Daniel. I think it's interesting that you pointed out Ayn Rand in particular. I was going to kind of maybe mention that, but I didn't know if it was too far-fetched, but I think it's interesting you mentioned
that. I do want to bring up two quotes from the movie that encapsulate that theme that I really like. And it happens at the beginning when Helen has to go pick up Dash from the principal's office because he put the tack on the teacher's chair, but he can't prove it because he was going so fast. And she's like, we've got to find a better way to like, you know, get, you know, whatever, to keep you busy or whatever, she says to Dash. And he goes, well, I would if you let me go out for sports. And she's like, you know, we can't let you go out for sports or whatever. And he's like, I just want to be special. And she's like, everybody's special, Dash. And he's like, that's another way of saying nobody is. And like, that's a very interesting, you know, like he wants to be incredible. He wants to run around, you know, but he can't. I don't know.
I think it's more speaks to denying what you are or what you want. What's going to give you pleasure in life? It's the same with the dad. He hates his life because he has to hide what he is. Hmm. I think it speaks more to that than it does to Ayn Rand and all that, but it's the villain even is a villain because he doesn't accept that he's a genius. He wants to be strong and be a jock and be Mr. Incredible. He's not willing to accept, oh, I'm a genius and could do, I build these robots, I build this technology that can beat the supers, but instead of focused on beating the supers, he should just do good and do good with what he's good at. I think that's more of what the whole theme is that you shouldn't deny what you are. You shouldn't hide what you are. You should be proud of what you are.
Yeah.
And run with it.
Yeah. And like at the end when they're all trapped and he's like telling him his whole story about his plan. And he's like, I'm going to be the new superhero everyone loves. And I'm going to give everyone my technology and everyone will be super. And when everyone's super, no one will be. That's his whole plan. Like if I can't be super, nobody's going to be super. Like,
yeah.
But really, everyone should be proud of how. Yeah.
And it starts from the presumption that like someone would want to do that, someone who would want to create equality, only want to do that out of like spiteful jealousy. Like the only motivation is people who want to.
Right. It's a subtext.
Equality. It's just, well, they really are just, they're mediocre people who just wish they were special. And so they want to try and forcibly equalize the playing field that's not equal. Like you said, yeah. because Syndrome is like actually not, though, like you said, he actually was a genius that came up with the technology.
Right.
And I think it's a little more complicated than that. Like there's the plot about the insurance company too, and like how he also villainizes the insurance company, which is another interesting segment of the movie that
complicates it too. That point in the movie is supposed to be showing like, oh, he used to be a superhero and now he's just doing this mundane office work. But you see him sort of be a superhero. Like, don't you wish there was a superhero working for an insurance company that would like tell a real crying old lady how to get her loan approved or whatever he does? He says like, fill out this form and whatever. Like, he actually like is like a real life superhero in that moment. I think that's kind of interesting.
Well, and he comes home from work that day and doesn't Helen ask him, like, how was your day? Like, saving more lives, like, whatever, like, through your insurance. And he's just like, oh, yeah, like, wish I could just actually help people without just teaching them how to get cut through the red tape. Like, yeah, I think that it is a very good parallel of, like, he hates this job with this, like, villainous boss who just wants to save all the money for like their share, I think even says like shareholders and stuff. But like Bob's like, we're a health insurance company. Aren't we supposed to be helping people? Like we should be helping people. Like,
yeah, it's true.
Yeah, no, it's an important theme in this film about the mundaneness of work and sort of it's almost portrayed as an evil in and of itself. To do a good job for a boss with bad motives is not condoned in any way in this movie. I mean, nobody's really very happy with their work unless they're superheroes, you know? So I thought that was fascinating. I'm not sure why. Take a thesis statement. You know, what is the Incredibles movie really saying about capitalism or mm-hmm. work in America, because it's not very flattering.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah.
It's kind of, yeah. I mean, it's a little self-serving on his part that, cause like what we're saying right now is he's a superhero because he helps people penetrate the bureaucracy. Right. But he's so worried about living up the good old days that he doesn't see that he's doing good where he is.
Right.
But that never gets resolved other than the fact that he needs to focus on his family. And that was in front of his face and he should have been focusing on that the whole time.
Yeah.
But he was doing good at his job.
Yeah. They could have had an alternate ending to this movie he like ends up going back and realizes that I guess I can do good here. They go to a new city and start a new life and they decide to be superheroes in their quote unquote mundane life. Yeah. I think that's a great point. They never really do address that issue at the end in the way they do in the beginning.
I mean, I guess they do say they have to relocate and stuff. So there's hope for that. But honestly, I have to be honest, I haven't seen Incredibles 2. So there you go.
I saw it at work when I was like half seeing it. So I'm not sure how it resolves it. But the ending scene where Dash is at the track meet and he's like, and Dash is encouraged to win second place instead of first place. Shows that they're learning to like adjust to like life with other people, that it's not always about winning and being the best all the time.
That's a great point.
He wins second place, is that right?
Yeah. He's like, oh. No, slow down. And there's like a guy just staring at them, like, what? He's like, wait, go for a second, close second.
Dash's like face is so well animated too, the way he's looking at his parents all confused. He's just like, what do you want me to do?
Oh, close second, got it. Okay. cool. Another aspect, can we also just talk for a second about how cool Edna is?
Oh, dude, we've gotten this far in the podcast. We haven't really talked about Edna.
Well, I guess.
Edna is great.
So, I mean, I think it's time to transition into the next part, which was to talk about the voice actors and the characters and their performances. So Edna is like sort of stole this movie. She's really such a minor character, but like, you know, her whole scene is so cool. And like, I always love the scene when like Helen shows up and she's just like, you're here, darling. Like, you know, I started at the basics and she's like showing her all the cool suits she made. And Helen's just like, why are you making all these suits? Yeah. So I love when like he shows up, he's like, I need a patch job. And she's like, what? this is a hobo suit. You will not be seen in it. And then she's like, I miss making all my, you know, all the super suits. She's like, I used to design for gods. Mm-hmm. I just love that line. For
another Ayn Rand or any Ayn Randian sort of.
Yeah, bring you back to the origin of superheroes and like.
Yeah, anyway. Yeah. We can get off that. It was just a thought. It's fun. Yeah, no, I love her whole sequence. She's like Q from James Bond, right? Or is Q the one that shows him all the trinkets he gets to use? No, Q is the leader of MI6 or whatever.
No. Q, you're right. M is the leader of MI6.
Oh, M is the leader. Q is the technology.
M is sort of like, ooh, Mirage, M. Mm? Mm? I know she's working for the villain, but it's like the same idea.
That'd be doing MI6 dirty.
Yeah.
No, Judi Dench.
Yeah.
Love Judi Dench.
But yeah, I mean, those are the best parts of the James Bond films is when Q is showing off all the gear. So this was.
And what does this do? It blows up, you know, the whole thing. No, that's my sandwich, damn it.
Yeah.
You know, stuff, those little scenes, yeah, totally. You know.
That's good.
So, yeah, so Edna's a great character, voiced by Brad Bird. We have our main characters, Bob Parr, Mr. Incredible, is voiced by Craig T. Nelson. And I know you were saying they modeled Mr. Incredible off of Brad Bird, but I feel like he looks a lot like Craig T. Nelson also, honestly.
He's a big dude.
Craig T. Nelson is known for, wasn't he in Parenthood?
Oh, yeah, yeah. Wait, Coach. He doesn't really look like
that. Oh, Coach. Yeah, Coach was like his main thing.
He doesn't look like Mr. Incredible.
Yeah, he kind of does. Maybe. He's got the same nose and like forehead, not the same chin.
Yeah, maybe you're right. I can see it now, I guess, if I look.
I met him in Ojai.
Oh, you met him.
He was being like awarded some like achievement award for the Ojai Film Festival, and I saw him in a coffee shop.
Cool.
Nice.
Same coffee shop I saw Ellen in too. But I didn't shake her damn hand.
Back to back. Pixar movie people.
That's true. I didn't even think about that. But yeah, that's true.
Yeah.
But anyway. I loved Coach.
I've never seen it at all. But yeah. I know a lot of people loved it.
He's really good. And he's also really good in The Family Stone.
Yeah.
As the patriarch guy.
Yeah.
Anyway.
Of course, we have the wonderful Holly Hunter as Helen Parr. I think I know she has such an interesting voice, but I feel like it just works so well as Elastigirl. Like, she does such a good job conveying this, like, kind of cool chick, but also this, like, really strong mother.
Totally.
And I'm so captivated by Elastigirl because of her performance.
Yeah.
There's, like, a sex appeal with her voice, which I wasn't really aware of, but my roommate was like, oh no, that voice is so sexy.
And like that, oh no.
Because I was like saying, like, doesn't it seem a little out of place? Because it's such a character voice. It's not like a motherly voice at first when I was thinking about it. But then it turns out it is. It is very. But sure. There's like a, you know, a raspy, you know, I met this girl at the bar. She's a little older, but hey.
Yeah.
Kelly. I don't know. Yeah. Are you aware of why or how Helen got cast? You know, it is an interesting casting choice.
I actually don't know any facts about how they picked these actors or who suggested it. I actually don't know that story. That I feel like at this point, Pixar was so big that they probably just like had some casting calls, called some agents and had auditions, you know. I don't know. It's not like the other ones where they specifically wanted, you know, like they definitely wanted Tom Hanks and they definitely wanted Billy Crystal. Yeah.
Okay.
She might have been kind of bigger at that time too. Didn't she have a show?
She was in this second season of Succession and I thought she was good in that. Yeah, she was like, it wasn't like she was the main character. Oh, Saving Grace. That's what you're thinking of? Saving Grace?
Yeah, that makes sense.
Of course, we have the wonderful Samuel L. Jackson as Frozone. Classic. Where's my super suit?
Did you say this already? Apparently they chose him because they, Bill Bird wanted somebody who had, quote, the coolest voice
to play Frozone. Oh, because he's Frozone?
Yeah.
So we were, so, okay. I've been into watching Once Upon a Time on Disney Plus, which is a silly show, I know. But the,
like, oh, Kelly.
The whole fourth season is about, like, Frozen and, like, Elsa and about, like, the idea of having, like, ice powers. And so then we were watching The Incredibles this week, and I was like, Frozone has Elsa powers. They have the same powers. They can just, like, create ice. And, like, just want to throw that out there, that that's kind of cool.
I said,
can she, like, make it, like, a winter forever, though?
That's what I said.
Yeah, she has, like, more power.
She's like a sorceress. Yeah. And he's like ice.
He's man. Just like, I need a drink of water to make ice. Like,
right. Oh, and he yeah. needs moisture.
He
in
needs
the air.
Moisture right. in the air. Or yeah.
So I so back to the original thing of, like, how do you think that Pixar treats the superhero genre?
Yeah.
Or superheroes. They're very much more like X-Men. Like, there's genetic involvement. It's not this magical thing.
Yeah.
Right.
You know, there, nobody's they, Thor.
It's,
nobody's.
It's the not Hulk. The I've gotten bitten by the spider story. It's not,
right. Yeah. Exactly. No, or Venom, some weird, you know, alien juice. So,
or you just no. are an alien, like super.
Right.
Right.
Superman's just like an alien.
You're definitely. An alien, but you look exactly
unexplained
like everybody.
Magic. An alien. Yeah.
Yeah. Well. So.
I guess X-Men was the one that pioneered the getting into the, like, genetic element.
Well, yeah, they really leaned into it.
Genetic power.
Yeah, in terms of, like, the racism of that situation, that X-Men is all about that. Like, the
eugenics.
Well, sure. I mean, that's Magneto's thing. Yeah, he wants to make, like, the whole world all mutants and, like, let evolution take the next step. And then, some of the humans are like, mutants are evil, disgusting creatures that need to be controlled. And yeah, they really lean into that whole genetics thing.
Well, it's, I mean, yeah, it's, they're going off of history, you know, originally yeah. schizophrenia was demons. And so drill a hole in the head, let them out. You know, it's that kind of thinking, just on a more crazy futuristic level.
Yeah.
They would drill.
They're out there, guys. Heads. Oh, yeah, that was the, you have demons, you're possessed, you drill a hole in their head with, like, the old hand drill that, like, spins, and you put a little hole in their head, and the demons will come out, but really, they're just, like, an old-school lobotomy.
Yeah,
so they just acted like just vegetables, and it's like, oh, they're cured, but really, you just drilled their brain out, but it's okay.
Where were we? Oh, yeah, we're talking about Frozone. Anyways, yeah, that super famous scene, everyone thought was hilarious. He's like, where's my super suit? Why do you need to know?
Oh, God. People quoted that so many times.
Yeah.
Done and requoted so many.
They say, like, the world's in danger. She's like, my evening's in danger. He's like, tell me where my suit is, woman. We were talking about the greater good. Greater good? I am your wife. I am the greatest good you're ever going to get. Yeah. Yeah, we would just quote that. We thought it was hilarious. Classic Pixar,
you know,
moment.
It sort of struck me as progressive, even though I didn't really even know what it was, but just a representation of, like, a Black family. I don't think it's quite tokenism, although maybe some people could see it that way. I think it's just, like, a representation of, like, the sort of mundane thing you see in the Incredibles family, but instead it's in, like, a sort of stereotypical Black household instead of the stereotypical white household. And I don't mean with kids and everything, just the, but, like, the bickering and the way that they do it, sort of the yeah. tude that they show or whatever. Maybe
it was just, it was, like, more urban because they're yeah. in, like, a high rise
yeah.
building.
Totally.
Very modern. I think they chose not to have children is kind of the vibe.
It's
right?
like, yeah, it's like a little more bohemian. It's like, we're going to live, yeah. they're like living the urban life without children.
Right.
I was going to say they have, like, a way, yeah, they have, like, a high rise, like, way nicer house. Like, what is Lucius's, you know, mundane job where he's, like, clearly wealthy, you know, which I thought was
sells water. Probably got an ice company. Doesn't have to have any machines. He just does it all himself.
Oh, that's so with funny.
Like that. Ice everywhere. It's perfect.
Yeah, going
global
back-
warming my ass.
Going back to the animation topic, I know that was a long time ago, but the way they animated his like ice, like how he can like throw the ice and like ski on it, it looks really cool.
Yeah, it does.
The they fluffy do really ice.
Well, he can like differentiate between making snow and ice. Like he icicles, can make different yeah. versions of right, frozen
like
water.
Hearts, he has like a yeah. Sorry.
He has like a snowboard, surfboard type thing.
Which I think he has in the later scene, but he doesn't have when he's got Dash with him. It's weird. Mm. It's like a little after that he like shoots it out of his shoes.
Yeah.
Out of his shoes. Yeah, I thought it was like a little circle.
But it shoots out of his shoes. Yeah.
Okay.
Before that, he can just like his shoes just must have some sort of like skiing capability that he can like glide on the snow really easily. Mm. Like
that's probably what people in the 60s thought with skiing would become.
Yeah.
Yeah. Got my ski shoes.
Shoes. That's it. That's all you need.
And then of course, Jason Lee does the voice of Syndrome. And I think he does a really cool job. I like Syndrome's voice in this for sure.
Yeah,
he's the like my name is Earl guy, right?
Yeah, I don't really know him like that much, really, as an actor.
What's the guy from Deadpool? Who's that guy again?
Ryan Reynolds.
I feel like they should do a movie where they're like brothers or something. Like, I feel like yeah. there's some similarity between those guys to me. Like,
who's the bigger fuck up though? Who fits that bill?
Wait, I guess what? Ryan
Reynolds. I just feel like they would be brothers, but one's a fuck up and one's not.
Yeah.
And they both have been the fuck up guy.
Yeah.
So and it's just kind of, you know.
Who would be it? Yeah.
And then, of course, last but not least, John Ratzenberger does make his appearance at the very end as the Underminer. They almost didn't have him in this movie, but they decided to bring him in finally at the very end. Next, it's time to turn over to Jacob to talk about the very famous musical score of the movie. So take it away.
Yeah, super famous. So like we talked about earlier, Brad Bird's vision was to have it look like the future from the view of 1960s. So originally he hired John Barry, who did 11 James Bond movies from 1963 to 1987. He also composed the theme for Dr. No, the first James Bond movie. So he was like the James Bond go-to composer. And so he did the trailers. And then he also did the Jack thing. His music on Her Majesty's Secret Service was in the trailer, which is actually a really obscure James Bond movie. It's the only one like that no one would know who the actor playing James Bond is. And so that happened. And then John Barry said no, because he was worried it was going to just sound like James Bond music, that he didn't feel like he was up to making it sound different. So then eventually Michael Giacchino was hired, and the soundtrack came out 3 days before the film. It won a bunch of awards, but kind of more obscure awards. It was nominated for a Grammy for best score soundtrack for visual media. And then it's also noted that music that was in the trailers from John Barry previous was not included in the soundtrack. Mm-hmm. A bunch of different stuff from David Arnold's Project Shaken and Stirred, which is a guy who did a bunch of James Bond themes after the fact. And then the other thing that Giacomo added was the Jack Attack, a little short. They included the Alla Turca movement from Mozart's Piano Sonata number 11 and the fourth movement of Ein Klein Nacht Music and Dies Irae from Mozart's Requiem. So it got a little real there, a little heavy. Another interesting thing, I'm not an expert about this soundtrack, but interesting stuff about it is it's so brass heavy, and they wanted that 60s sound, so they recorded everything on tape. There was no digital recording.
Wow.
So
I didn't really know that. Cool. I know that.
What's his name? So Bird wanted an old feel
at like a score of like an old movie. And a guy named Dan Whalen, who was the recording engineer, you know, suggested that they do it all on tape. So he said yes. And Giacchino said that that's the right way to record music. So he was all about doing it old school. So really something that's the juxtaposition of super high tech computer imaging and all the software used for that. And then they went super old school with the recording of the music, which honestly, like it sounds like a James Bond film, like totally. Just constant brass, which I love it. I love it. Mm-hmm. But I do think it's probably why they didn't get any Oscar noms, because of there's no songs. It's all just brass and orchestration.
Yeah, but it's so well orchestrated. I can't believe it was nominated for original score. It makes me mad.
But the thing is, I mean, okay.
But I guess because it wasn't super innovative. I don't care if it wouldn't have won. Yeah. I just feel like it deserves some recognition.
And another big point is that not only do they do it on tape, but they did it live with the full orchestra. So, and that was a huge thing, is that it, in order to convey what's going on in the script, they felt that all the musicians had to play off of each other. That was like a huge thing that the conductor wanted, which the conductor's name was Tim Simonek or Simonek. So that was, you know, it was kind of a departure from what was going on in film right then. It was all about digital and how can we edit and do all these crazy things we could do now with technology, but they decided to not do that. But every other element of the film is technologically advanced. It's pretty cool. I think that's cool.
It's like that retro future theme.
Exactly. Yeah.
In a way. Yeah.
Like, so in the '60s, they couldn't even imagine digital recording. So, you know, there you go.
Yeah. Was there any data on like how well the soundtrack sold? Like,
That's a good question. I didn't do that.
Let me Google that, because I didn't even think about like, but now I'm really curious because, gosh.
I mean, it won awards in other places. It was up for a Grammy, so it probably did something good.
I'm just curious because, I mean, I saw that fact about, you know, how apparently Finding Nemo is like the most sold DVD of all time. Yeah. I'm not saying this is the most sold soundtrack of all time. That's probably like Star Wars or something, but
For sure was a bump, which is probably unique to this in 2004 for like bands, high school, all these, like you guys all have some memory of that, right? So it's unique, I think, to this movie.
I mean,
that it's so band oriented.
Dude, even still today, my band students like want to play The Incredibles.
People who enjoy or are part of brass music.
Yeah, you know, I mean, I'm a brass kid. Like, I totally, but I listen to this soundtrack nonstop. Okay, band geek alert, you guys. I listen to this so much that I could conduct through, like, I would practice conducting to the soundtrack. Like, I can conduct through the entire, not anymore, probably, but I could conduct through the whole soundtrack. I knew where all the time signature changes were. I knew where to cue every part of the orchestra.
That's good practice.
I think that's probably why I'm a decent conductor, because I practiced when I was, like, 12 in my room.
Yeah, sure.
To a very complicated score.
Yeah, no, it is complicated. Time signature-wise.
It definitely helped especially. My ear in that realm, too, like... And just for fun, listening to sound like any music in like middle school, I would practice conducting, not like to be super crazy about like my style, but just practice finding where the tempo, like where, what time signature are we in? Is there any time signature changes? Like, I think that also like the math brain in me likes that, like, where's the count structure? So for those of you who want to know, The Incredibles main theme is in 5/4 time. And it switches back and forth between 3/4 and 4/4 as well, which is pretty cool.
You had your students play it? How many times have you had your students play it?
I've never played this with my students, no.
Okay. It's tough.
It's pretty hard.
I feel like I played this in multiple bands when I was a teenager. This was like, yeah, I was in marching band.
Sorry, kids, if you're listening to this, but I just don't have the trumpet players to do this music right now. Maybe someday.
laid it down.
Shots fired.
Whatever, they're not listening to this.
But honestly, I think a lot of high schools that even do it don't have the trumpets to do
this.
That's true. So, I mean, it's not a knock to high schoolers playing trumpet. It's just the fact that these are the best studio musicians ever, and they got them all together to play trumpet.
We played this at Biola Youth Music and only had three trumpet players, but one was like a college student, and he like did all the crazy parts. And that's like the year I learned how to play trumpet.
Did he do it well?
Yeah, he's a great trumpet player. And then one of the like seniors played the alto saxophone solo, which is also really complicated. The saxophone solos.
Yeah.
Yeah. For sure. So really cool jazz music for sure. I would love to, you know, have my kids do this, but honestly, I just want to play this music. It sounds so fun to play, you know? Anyways.
But it also makes sense that jazz, setting aside the fact that the director has also directed a Mission Impossible movie and apparently has a huge affinity for James Bond thematic elements, both musically and just in general, that jazz is the best genre to portray the physicality of the movie. Because it's just like this way, that way, that way, this way, this way, that way, that way. Mm-hmm. And like, oh, he's so fast. And then there's a machine going rolling this way. Like, it's just, it's so bombastic, I guess, and just constantly changing direction, which is perfect. And that's jazz.
Yeah. Well, and like they use the brass a lot to be like, pow, bang, mm-hmm. boom.
Yeah,
like which is like Batman, you know, onomatopoeia sort of stuff,
right?
Bam,
yeah. So all that's right. My music section.
Thank you, that was great. I learned things. Next new section, I wanted to kind of start talking about how the Pixar movies are have influenced the theme parks that have slowly transitioned more to Pixar characters than the original Disney characters, which for a Disneyland lover, Disney kid, like, kind of makes me sad. Like, they changed all of California Adventure into like, or not all of California Adventure, but the whole pier is like Pixar Pier now. So they did like renovate and redo Pixar Pier over, or what was, we used to be called Paradise Pier, now it's called Pixar Pier. And the classic California Scream and roller coaster they have redone, and it is now called the Incredicoaster. So the theme of the movie, the idea is that you're chasing Dash through the roller coaster, which is kind of cool. It's still the same really roller coaster.
Anyway, you don't see him at like the front of the coaster.
Yeah, you do.
Oh, what? He's there?
Yeah. What? Like running. Yeah. They put they're in the ride. Like you see them, him and you, then they have like these like lines to be like, look at he ran. Check it out on YouTube.
Whoa, okay. I thought I did check it out, but I didn't remember. I remember.
I hear that it's basically the same ride.
No, it's exactly the same ride. They just put them in it.
Yeah.
And they changed the music, obviously, to the Incredibles music, I'm pretty sure.
Yeah, they do.
And there's also the Pixar Parade. You have the Incredibles characters in the Pixar Parade, and you can meet Elastigirl and Mr. Incredible and take pictures with them. And then at Hollywood Studios, they just added like Toy Story Land, and there's this big building called Pixar Place, and you can do something called the Edna Mode Experience, and you can meet Edna. And I'm not exactly sure what the Edna Mode Experience is. We didn't do that when we went there a few years ago, but I imagine you get to like maybe make a super suit or something, which sounds pretty cool.
Yeah, something but, like that, yeah.
So The Incredibles is in the theme parks a lot less than some of the other Pixar movies, obviously, but they are in there. All right, so we're getting towards the end. Here's the part where we all get to share our favorite, least favorite sequence, favorite character, and then our overall thoughts and letter grades. So we are going to start going around with our least favorite sequence. Jacob, do you have a least favorite sequence?
Yeah, I think I don't really like the we're rescuing people on the DL, but then we break through the wall and we're in the jewelry shop. I didn't like that because there's so much possibility to just talk out of that shit. And and then also like, I'm going to get a drink of water. Don't shoot me. But the moment he gets frozen, he shoots. Like, it just, I don't know. It could have been better written, just to like get them out of there. Like, hush, hush. I don't know. It was just weird. Yeah. It almost seemed like they were trying to do something like, because Frozone was black, there was almost like a weird police thing. And that's, I think, just the climate we're in right now.
I was going to say, at the time, they definitely weren't doing that. But I know. Everyone's brain like, probably went there now.
We were all just like, oh, shit, this is what I have to think. But yeah, so that would be my least favorite.
It's true. Watching that scene, obviously, today, I'm like, dude, they would have just shot him.
Like, yeah. Well, I mean, the fact that he has to be so overt, like, I'm just getting a drink of water, it sort of, you know, illustrates or shows the sort of systemic racism that exists. Like, we didn't see it then, but we see it now.
Yeah,
a little more clearly. Sure. They have to fear for their lives way more. And, you know, maybe you could have swapped the characters and it was Mr. Incredible being like, I'm just getting a drink of water. Maybe.
But that also speaks to Samuel Jackson. Like, that's his reading of it. And sure. He's also like a big activist for that stuff. Yeah. So he's always going to put that in where he can. And so, I mean, he might have been thinking of it, but the director wasn't, and people weren't in 2004.
Right.
But for sure now, that's what I was thinking. And it was like, this is like, you know, a sign of
age. It's crazy because that isn't in 2004, that wouldn't have been probably what people were thinking. Or unless someone was thinking it, which would be...
I mean, people were thinking it, really, not us.
Yeah, not us.
The people making the movie, though.
Yeah,
maybe.
Yeah. Could be.
All right, Daniel, least favorite sequence.
This was hard. I was thinking about this right up until the middle of this podcast. There isn't a full-on sequence that I dislike. Usually smaller scenes. I'd have to pick probably the scene where Syndrome captures Mr. Incredible and almost kills him for the first time, where he's like introduced to Syndrome and he's announcing who he is and he's monologuing and he goes into his like his worldview thing. Like, I'd probably have to put that just because of my issues with that worldview. But that's a short scene. And just a couple other lines of dialogue. There isn't like a bad extended sequence, really.
I love that scene when we meet Syndrome. I was going to bring this up earlier and I forgot, but it is funny how they make fun of the like villain monologuing trope in this movie. For sure.
Yeah, it's good. And you know, and Jason Lee's voice line readings of it are great.
Mm-hmm. I mean,
I wouldn't have thought that you wouldn't think of Jason Lee as someone who would be perfect for a role, but he was. His voice lines really work for the character. But yeah, that's hard. That was a hard one.
All right, Cynthia, least favorite sequence or scene?
I'm scrambling to figure that out, Kelly. I definitely have my favorite sequence. Might be because I'm not perhaps as familiar with the movie as all the rest of you. I think the robot kind of chase scenes, menacing scenes. It was just so repetitive. And I wasn't enthralled with the robot. I mean, it was a very scary character, but it wasn't my favorite scene.
All right, Jimmy, do you have an answer now?
I think Jacob picked a good one when they're rescuing the people from the fire. When they bust through the wall, I'm like, wouldn't that hurt their heads or something? Like the people he's carrying, like on his shoulder, like how does that work? And then, yeah, why couldn't they just explain to the police officers, like, we just saved these people from the building that's burning right there? Like, I did have that sort of thought when I watched it before Jacob said it. I just didn't recall it until he said it. I sort of had the thought, like, couldn't you just explain? So,
but they're wearing the masks and like they don't want to be recognized as Frozone and Mr. Incredible.
Right.
Yeah, they don't want to bring any attention to what they were doing.
Sure.
At all.
Yeah.
To like
the I don't have a better answer.
Papers, you don't know.
Yeah, I see what you're saying, and why think, it's justified.
Think how easy it would be to find Mr. Incredible with just a mask on. The giant motherfucker with the 5-foot wide shoulders. Like, it's just, I mean, it's a little weird.
Yeah, I love this movie so much. Like, I want to say I don't really have a least favorite sequence. And I think if I were to actually really answer, I think I might have to pick like the very, very end when like they go back home and like Syndrome stealing Jack, and then he like goes up and tries to steal him, and then like she has to throw her cat. It's sort of just like, okay, I get it. We're trying to tie up the Syndrome thing, but we just had this crazy big battle scene and you feel so relieved that it's over. And then there's this one extra little coda at the end of this other scene. I was like, maybe not super necessary, but I do get the idea of him going into their house. Like Brad Bird was saying, he thought that was really creepy. And I do like the way they tie in the whole cape idea, which we didn't talk about earlier, but when he's like, wants a new suit and he's like, and a cape, and Edna's like, no capes. Yeah. And she tells all the story about all the superheroes that got killed because of their capes, and how that ties back at the end with Syndrome is cool. But I just kind of feel like, I could take or leave that very ending scene maybe. All right, now favorite sequence. And I'm going to start with Cynthia because I know she has definitely a favorite one she wants to talk about.
My favorite scene is the Dash chase scene. Mm-hmm. I loved that. And it went so fast and he was so threatened and there were so many things after him. And, you know, and he runs across the water and it was just brilliant. It was thrilling.
Yeah, that's probably my favorite scene too. Like, I didn't even think about it before, but when I was talking about it earlier, I was like getting so excited thinking about that scene. Like, the music is great. All their powers come out. I love when he starts running across the water and he's running and he makes this face like, oh no, I'm going to get hit the water. And then he realizes he can run on the water and his little giggle he does, he's just like, like, it's just so great. Like, that scene's great. Great, great action scene. So yeah, I'll just tag on to that's also my favorite sequence.
Yeah, just count me into that one too. Might as well get it out of the way now. It's when Violet first uses her powers, the family is reunited, we first see them. Are they on their suits?
They're on their suits, and like they run into each other and they're like, oh, I'm so happy to see you. And
I mean, then that's just the good payoff at the end. But even prior to that, just Dash's dash through the forest, the Endor like sequence is great.
Well, I do love too when they meet up and then the like planes come back in and like they all just go like, and the music, it's like happy music, like, oh, like happy strings. And then the threat comes back and it's just like, da, 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 da. And they all go like, ah, and they all start like fighting together.
Yeah.
It's just really cool. All right. Jacob, favorite scene?
Yeah, I agree with you guys, but I'll add another good scene, which is very mundane, I guess you would say. When he gets home and he like hits his car, puts a handprint in his car, and all the like levels of frustration, he picks up his car and he sees the kid. I've had so many moments of that in my life of just frustration. You break the thing that you actually need.
Yeah, when you didn't pick up solve your car anything. And frustration, Jacob.
And then, well, I haven't done that yet. 2020's not over, ladies and gentlemen. But it's just one of those things where you get pissed off, you hit something, you break something, and you like have an alleviated moment. And then you realize, I just made my life way worse by breaking or doing what I just did. And just that level of frustration. And it's very real. And if you lose your job or have something go wrong and those things happen, and then you see a little kid seeing you and you're like, oh my God, I'm a monster. It's a powerful moment.
Daniel, favorite sequence.
I'm surprised no one said the opening sequence yet, but actually that was my second choice. I actually am going to pick the Edna sequences because I like the building anticipation and intrigue sequences of the movie, and both of the scenes where the one where Bob goes there and his interchange with her, and then the scene where she's showing off the different suits to Helen, and that's like juxtaposed with also where Bob is like infiltrating the base for the second time, and he goes through the volcano and he types in Kronos and sees the all the other superheroes that have been killed by Syndrome, and then the homing beacon goes off. That whole sequence is great.
Yeah, it's stressful. It's
building anticipation. Great, great stuff. That's like the middle sequence of the movie. It's great. Mm.
Cool.
All right. Favorite character? I'm going to start with Jacob this time.
Favorite character? Yeah, I would go with Mr. Incredible. I think he's got a lot of layers, and he's the typical strong, silent type, but really he starts to understand that his feelings deserve a voice. And that's what festered and made him lose sight of what's important. I think that that's a great arc. Mm. We can all learn from that.
Nice. Yeah, well said. Yeah. Daniel, favorite character?
I might pick Helen, Elastigirl. I think she's the most interesting character. I think her arc that she goes through, the way she handles things, and I think she's actually the most interesting character in the movie. Like, you get a sense of that. I know the Incredibles too, we'll get into more of her, but I think that she, like, that's a character that could have easily, like, relied on cliches for what, like, the woman will, like, get angry in that situation or whatever. And I think the character ends up being a lot more interesting than that, and it works, for my view. So that's why I would pick her.
I think that's a great pick, and I think you're right.
Yeah.
Jimmy?
A lot of good characters. I like a lot of them for different reasons. But I get the most enjoyment out of watching Dash. So it's got to be Dash for me. He's, like, you know, funny in his own little kid way. He's got my favorite scene as, like, sort of his scene. And I don't know what else to say. Just Dash.
Yeah, he's a fun one. Cynthia, favorite character?
I like Violet. I like the way she changes and discovers herself, and even the symbolism of her hair, where she hides herself and then is open about it. And as a result of that, becomes more accepted by her peers. And she just gets to grow up and become a strong young woman. I love that.
Yeah. A lot of cool characters. I want to, like, you know, throw out, like, runner up to Frozone, of course, just being so cool. Mm-hmm. But I agree with Daniel. My favorite character is by far Elastigirl. I think if you had asked me this when I was a kid, when I was really into this movie, I would have just said, like, Frozone or Dash or someone. But yeah, just how strong she has to be as the mom, as the woman, looking out for the kids, making sure her husband doesn't kill himself in his, you know, midlife crisis, and, you know, kicking ass. And yeah, just being so poised the whole way, and how much she loves and cares about her family. I think I agree with Daniel that she's definitely the most interesting character. And I feel like Jacob said about Mr. Incredible, I think we can learn from her as well, how to be in a tough situation. All right, we have reached the end. It is time for overall thoughts and letter grades. And I think we'll start with Daniel this time.
Well, I have, it's been like 15 years, now 16 years. I've had a lot of complicated thoughts on this movie. It's meant a lot of different things to me over the years. Like I said, I remember being blown away when I saw it, and it towered over my high school years. And, like, you watch it now, and, like, technical elements of the movie are so good. Like, the style and the animation, the writing and the pacing and the voice acting, and all of that is, like, nearly perfect. And just like a nearly perfect movie, but, like, and part of it is sullied by the weird, toxic, like, Nietzsche influenced worldview of Brad Bird's pet weirdness. But I don't know. I mean, like, I want to say that this is, like, one of the greatest movies of this century and give it an A+, but my thoughts are very complicated and I'll knock it down to an A.
All right. Just because of the Nietzsche part.
Yeah, I still think that I can't totally get on board with some of those ideas, but other elements of the movie are good.
All right, Cynthia.
I very much enjoyed this movie. I would give it a B+. I think it's very well done and very imaginative. I happen to think it was a little bit repetitive. I think the movie could have been about 20 minutes shorter. I just didn't know if we needed every chase scene and every kind of crazy predicament that they put in. But one thing I want to say about the movie is it had definitely very sad scenes. I mean, when Mr. Incredible is tied up and he can't get out and he thinks his family's dead, is so sobering and so sad. And then the movie also took you to high exhilaration points and comedy. So very well done. But not in my most favorite of all Pixar movies. So I'm going to give it a B.
All right.
Sure.
Jacob?
Yeah. I think it strikes on depth and the family and the idea that it's humans now. I think that they took a really good stab at that for the first time. And I would give it a 97. So I guess that's an A+ or an A.
I mean, when I was in high school, 97 was an A+, but
I think it is still.
Yeah.
All right. A+. Jimmy.
Yeah, they handled like the human elements super well. Like the emotional points of the movie are handled very well. It doesn't have that emotional gravitas that some of the other Pixar movies have for me. But what it does have is that superhero action element, which just makes it very entertaining to watch. I think, like my mom said, there are times maybe where you're kind of like, okay, like cool, like more action. But in general, it's so well designed and so well done. Like all those like little goopy guns that shoot onto Mr. Incredible as he's running through. Like, that's such a cool little superhero idea. And like the buzzsaw things that are chasing Dash. Like, I love those little vehicles. Like, and like, as Brian mentioned, so the design and the fun super hero action sequences boost it up. It's gotta be A. I think I'm gonna say A natural.
A natural.
I give it a 95, yeah.
So Brian had to leave early, but he did text me, and he also said he would give this movie an A. And I've said this a bunch of times, said it last week. This is my favorite Pixar movie out of all the Pixar movies. One of the biggest reasons being, like we said, how much I love the soundtrack. And it definitely, I think this movie as soundtrack honestly played a big role in me wanting to be a music teacher, to be honest. Like how cool it was to play this music and like the idea of teaching it and then wanting to conduct it, like I think was a big inspiration to me, honestly, to be a music teacher. So I think that's why one of the main reasons I hold it so dear to my heart. And then over the years, I've grown so fond about the adult and family themes of, you know, being a mom and like, is your husband cheating on you in the midlife crisis? And then being that kid who wants to hide and worried about their parents. And like, you know, as a kid, that stuff went over my head a little bit. Like I was kind of aware of it, but like now I love all those little characters in there. On this last watch, I really, really love Syndrome as a villain and his sort of, you know, vengeance aspect and also how silly he kind of is. I love the animation, all the little nuances. Like you said, the sets, the weird retro 60s thing is really cool. You know, Frozone's ice looks so cool. The action is so cool. Like, and I realized that on this watch too. Oh, I love this movie because how action oriented it is and how cool it is. And like Cynthia was saying, how fast paced those scenes are, but also those quiet, sad moments are in the movie too. It kind of gives you a little bit of everything. And I watch this movie at least once a year, if not more, and I will continue to love this movie. So it's an A+ for me. So there you have it. We've got, two A+'s, three A's, and a B. So pretty high up there as well. And I know we keep laughing about how we just keep giving these movies high marks. But
for now,
that'll change.
That'll change. It's getting closer to changing. We still got some good movies ahead on our next episode. So our homework and our listeners' homework is to watch the movie Cars, which, fair warning, I know there's a ton of people out there who love Cars. And I know mostly all of us are, not that we don't like the movie, but are not as familiar with this one. So it's definitely going to be an interesting conversation, I think, next time for
all of us. We do all drive cars, so that's a leg in.
That's true. We do
Put through cars. The door.
And I've been to Cars Land, so...
There you go.
Could talk about that. All right, guys. Thanks for listening to us. Let us know what you think about the new format. And we will see you next time to talk about Cars. Friday Forum Podcast is a JK Entertainment production. All thoughts and opinions by the participants are theirs and theirs alone. Original theme music by Jimmy Anthony. Please subscribe so you never miss an episode and rate and review us on Apple Podcasts. Feel free to follow us on Instagram at Friday Forum Podcast for updates about future episodes. And please email us at FridayForumPodcast@gmail.com to contact us and let us know what you think. I'm your host, Kelly Anthony. Thanks for listening, and we'll see you next time.